Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down.
Hey everybody, I'm Patrick Connor, and welcome back, of course, to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. In just a minute, my boy Bryn Jonathan Butler, who is, of course, man, you guys know him, author, filmmaker, Cuban fight enthusiast, of course, he's going to be joining us. And today we're doing another boxing history episode. We're going to be talking about Andrew Gullotta, man. Andrew Gullotta. Hot damn. It's quite the topic, man. There's plenty of controversy to draw from, some history there. It's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, you pretty much, you run the gamut of something I've spoken about many times. Bryn's talked about it, Aris and I have talked about it. The fact that boxing can encompass so many different things, in the sense that you get drama, controversy, sadness, happiness, elation, extreme adrenaline rushes, and it's basically something for the whole family, is what I'm saying. You know, it's uplifting, it's pretty crazy, it's sickening, it's disgusting, and often you're able to talk about a fighter and then all of those things, you know, have a fighter basically espouse all of those things throughout the course of his career. And that's definitely Andrew Gullotta. Whether you liked him, didn't like him, totally understandable either way, I would say. But nonetheless, you probably felt somewhat strongly about him or were entertained by him, on even if on some base level. And that's, I don't mean to put him down in any way, and that's something that Bryn and I will talk about too in a moment, his background and the fact that he did dedicate a lot of time and was actually a very accomplished fighter, especially as a heavyweight, as a Polish heavyweight. And yeah, we'll get into that stuff too, so it won't be all negative, but I think that that is kind of something that Bryn and I like to kind of peel back the layers on, you know, the psychology of being a fighter, even though neither of us really are. And I think that that kind of also is one of the reasons why it interests us and probably interests a lot of other writers and other quote-unquote pundits and people who talk about the sport a lot. You know, those, they say those who can't do teach, and think that that's probably carries some weight too in the writing sphere when it comes to boxing and combat sports, where, you know, there are often, this is also something Bryn and I have talked about before, but there are often complaints or criticism that a lot of the people who criticize the sport are not participants, or were not participants, have not been participants, are not in the shape to be participants, etc. And while a somewhat fair criticism is noted, at the same time, that's not going to erase the fascination, and it's a fascination I have, the psychology of a fighter, and that's something Bryn definitely likes to delve into as well, and there's no shortage of abnormal psych 101 to try to dissect and do some dime store psychology on Andrew Gullotta here. So anyway, very fun fighter to watch, at the very least, if we're being fair and if we're trying to start out on a fairly positive note here. If you're not that familiar with Andrew Gullotta, first of all, when the fuck were you born? No, first of all, you could probably go right on to YouTube in this day and age in 2020 where none of us have fucking anything to do at all. And yeah, go on to YouTube, search Andrew Gullotta. There will be several fights there. Probably the top fights that pop up are going to be the Riddick Bowe fights. Familiarize yourselves, because those will probably be the go-to holy shit, what the hell is going on fights in his career. And that might explain a little bit about what we're talking about. But you could also go through a number of his other fights and find that he was a very polished boxer at times. He was a very entertaining fighter in the sense that he would engage. He was aggressive. He was a good infighting heavyweight. That's something that a lot of people are perhaps not really used to seeing these days, because there aren't very many of them, if any. So you go through his career, even just on YouTube, and you can see that, yeah, pretty fun guy to watch overall. It's just that in the biggest moments, there were things. Yeah, there were mistakes made. There were people almost killed. You know, a couple riots, a couple assaults, a couple of unfortunate incidents. So I guess wait for Bryn for just a minute here, but I'll get into the history of Andrew Gullotta, and actually the history of a couple other things, and why the fact that Andrew Gullotta is, you know, his Polish descent, why is that even important? Why is that relevant whatsoever, obviously? Bryn just messaged me and said he'll be right on. So, as many people know, and especially if you've ever tuned into the history episodes, I'd like to talk a lot about actual history, world history, and things like that, and how those things tie into boxing history and how things develop in boxing. So Andrew Gullotta, of course, from a relatively bad part of Warsaw, Poland, and he was in Poland, according to Polish journalists, known as a quote-unquote street guy in Warsaw, known as a guy who was, you know, he was a troublemaker. He was somebody who was definitely not shying away from street fights. Bran, speaking of street fights, what up?
That's all I do. I live on the street. I fight anybody who's not wearing a mask.
That's what I was just talking about. I was talking about how basically we like to be boxing pundits and talk about it so much because we're just like enormous pussies.
I mean, yeah, I sleep with a cat on my pillow. What do you want from me?
That's what I'm saying. You know, I have like several pets and I'm building a fucking chicken coop. So let's talk boxing.
Let's talk a real Polish badass. I mean, not the Polish badass, who we all know exactly who I'm referring to, but another Polish badass.
Hashtag blame Bobby for that one there. But
yep.
I was just saying this shit. I knew a little bit about Gullotta, especially because obviously we grew up right around this time. I pretty vividly remember the bow fights. Like, that shit, that was crazy shit. And I remember some about the Holyfield, or, you know, like right around the Bo Holyfield, a little bit before that, and then the kind of like the succession all the way into the Gullotta fights with Bo. But then, you know, because of that kind of like nostalgia, I know a little bit more about it, or I feel like I remember it a little bit better. And also, one of the reasons why I feel like I know a little bit better, to be honest, is when Legendary Knights came out in the that series in the early 2000s. First of all, that is like some of the best shit HBO has ever done when it comes to sports.
No,
even though a couple of those history episodes were like fairly skewed, it still was really good. And of course, I think Liev Schreiber was doing the narration. That guy's, you know, a god in most countries. So that episode of Bo Gullotta, The Legendary Knights, is pretty much like you have to watch. It's good shit. And it talks a little bit about Andrew Gullotta's background. So apparently he grew up in Warsaw, in a pretty bad part of Warsaw, and was known as, like, you know, a street thug, a dude who ran the streets, was getting in fights on the streets and shit like that. And he, after the Olympics in 1988, literally fled Poland to the U.S. Because he got into a bar fight and hurt some guy, and rather than be prosecuted, he came to the U.S. So that's where we're starting out.
Which is awesome. I mean, the guy has over 100 wins as an amateur. He's a bronze medalist at the 88 Games in Seoul. You know, he's, you know, an accomplished certainly a blue chip prospect as a heavyweight. He's a big guy, 6'4". I want to say he was around 230, like kind of his best weight. Big, broad guy, but could punch in combinations, heavy-handed. Yeah, and just this, where he came from, I mean, a little bit like the president, you know, which granted far worse crimes looming in his personal life, but this was a guy kind of skating at the edge right from the beginning.
Yeah, and I mean, there's, like I was kind of touching on earlier, the psychology of a fighter, and, you know, again, I guess take with a grain of salt that this is to, like, non-fighters that you're hearing this from, but nonetheless, there is something really interesting about where a lot of fighters seem to come from, obviously both psychologically, but, like, literally, too. There's something that seems just so natural, going hand in hand, you know, lock and step with being a fighter and coming from awful beginnings, coming from hardship and coming from having to fight metaphorically in your life too. And I obviously don't mean to downplay anything about Andrew Gulotta's career, but he certainly, or his upbringing, but he certainly carried that through his career. And I mean, yeah, he's, like you said, Olympian. This is not just some random dude. He's not just some street guy either. But to risk all of that by being a street guy, you know, that's its own psychology.
He had some real demons. There's no question. I think, as we're going to get to, he carried those demons throughout his career. And I just wanted to make a point for any listeners that are not our age. When I'm referring to the president, cool figure, it's Abiyabuchi, who was this tremendous heavyweight prospect who went undefeated, great fights against Chris Bird, David Tua, biggest punch output ever. So, I mean, that was my reference there with some horrendous crimes with prostitutes where I think he trapped them or attempted rape or something. So Gulotta was, you know, definitely coming out of a lot of chaos when he came to the U.S., was fortunate to marry an American, which I can strongly identify with. I did the same thing. And off he goes as a professional, really running up a very impressive streak of, I want to say, in the neighborhood of 25-0 by the time he got to Bo. Does that sound right to you? 28-0.
Something like that, yeah. Well, and he almost didn't quite get there, because some of the shit that had wind up surfacing later actually surfaced in maybe like smaller doses earlier in his career, but still he was pretty well known, pretty successful. And I guess an important part of the story here is too that he had relocated to Chicago, which has a massive Polish population, you know, compared to the other ethnic groups, especially in and around Chicago. And I don't know, I mean, because I just like to know why. Apparently a big reason for this was because in the 1830s, there was a failed uprising in Poland. And basically a bunch of the people who had failed in this uprising relocated to Chicago for some reason, and that kind of started the Polish population in Chicago, and now it's like, yeah, it's a lot of Polish people there, and it caught on because of the steel mills and stockyards and stuff like that, as Chicago became a pretty massive city anyway. But Andrew Gulotta, I was actually just talking about this with my wife the other day, and I was kind of saying it to my daughter that one of the really interesting things about certain parts of the U.S., and it's not like the U.S. is unique in this regard either, but nonetheless, that's where I'm from, so that's kind of what I recognize. One of the interesting things is that there are a number of places in the U.S. and in big cities where you could literally relocate from your home country, wherever it is, and go into a community and not really have to learn English, because you're constantly around people who came from where you came from and speak your language. And, you know, I'm not speaking on, I don't give a fuck what language anybody speaks, so I'm not speaking on that. Just the ability to kind of transport from here to there and not really have to change lifestyle. And so the point is that Andrew Gullotta was still something of a name, something of a person, you know, of stature, going from Poland to Chicago, and found it pretty easy to... Well, and also, key element, large, skilled, white heavyweight, found it pretty easy to get dialed in to the boxing scene in Chicago and get with Main Events, which was an important promoter. Still is.
And I think I'd add to that that Polish are some, the Polish population in the U.S. are some of the most fervent, crazy boxing
yes.
fan enthusiasts out there. So he had a built-in
sports
fan base.
Sports enthusiasts.
Yeah, sports enthusiasts. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I mean,
but I mean, they are maniacal. Yeah, and they are just maniacally fervent fans. And so you'd have a built-in fan base to sell tickets to. So I think that would definitely fuel his ascent as well. And I mean, any fight I've ever been to where there's a Polish fighter, even if it's not a name that I recognize, you see the flags waving, you hear the chants. I mean, they're a great, great fan base that he had. And they had somebody to really cheer. I mean, somebody with the real bona fides as an amateur and just the size and the skills where he was a real prospect there on his way to Riddick Bowe, and it seemed like the only person who really didn't take him seriously was Riddick Bowe.
And that's the funny thing was that if you actually watch, so the fight immediately before he fought Riddick Bowe against Donnell Nicholson, who was, you know, a pretty skilled guy actually from Chicago, but he was trained by Eddie Mustafa Muhammad, former light heavyweight champion, and he was also an Olympian. You know, he was a skilled dude, but kind of fizzled out as a pro. But even so, he showed some serious weakness against Donnell Nicholson and looked at a few moments like he was going to quit, like he was headbutting him, he was shoving him around and shit like that when he couldn't put him away, and then Donnell Nicholson quit after round 7 or 8 or something like that. But then there was also a year before that against Samson Pua, who was also kind of like a, you know, guy with promise that fizzled out, a Tongan heavyweight. He bit Samson Pua, and that actually was, they said something about that in the ring at the time too. I have the article somewhere, but that's kind of like, you know, there were just kind of hints. Nothing of consequence yet. Nothing had really bitten him in the ass. But anyway, yeah, still a big, skilled, fairly smooth too when he was really on his shit. A white heavyweight who was visible, hit pretty hard, good infighter, which is something that, like I was saying earlier, people might not quite be familiar with today's heavyweights because we just, well, not even just heavyweights. A lot of fighters aren't very good infighters anymore, but especially heavyweights. So this guy would have caught people's eye. It's kind of funny that he also caught Riddick Bowe just at the perfect time in Riddick Bowe's career for him to be overlooking Andrew Gullotta too. The timing was just, it should have been the stereotypical crossroads scenario. That's what it should have been, but it was not.
No, I think you're absolutely right. He caught Bo at the perfect time. Bo was overconfident, never known for his discipline. Discipline was a huge issue for Bo. And on top of that, he's coming off of one of the great heavyweight trilogies of all time that probably, I don't know, took 20-30% off his fastball as a fighter. I mean, both those guys took a lot away from each other, Holyfield and Bo. And on top of that, Bo had inactivity. After the third Holyfield fight, he'd taken a year before he stepped up and took on Gullotta, and he just completely dismissed him, called him a bum publicly, and seemed to train as though he was facing just a walkover fight, despite the fact that Galata had all these attributes that we've mentioned and it racked up a 28-0 record, knocking out almost everybody he fought. So, yeah, timing was not good for Bo, and I distinctly remember this fight. I mean, just because it's always so exciting to see somebody like Bo, who at that time, you know, seemed like he certainly had the potential to be one of his generation's best heavyweights. I mean, I think he was at his peak. Certainly the Bo who fought Holyfield in the first fight, I don't think we ever saw that guy again, or really even close to that guy. But boy, at his best, Bo was somebody very, very special. I don't think there's any argument that Lennox Lewis, he was running from Lewis the whole time as a pro after what happened in the Olympics. This was a real gutsy performance by Bo to survive the kind of punishment he took. And, I mean, it's an interesting fight to rewatch just because you can hear the announcers recognizing pretty early on Bo is really going to have to get out not being stopped pretty early in this fight, certainly by the middle of the fight. And then everything goes the way it did, where Galata put on a performance in terms of low blows that made it one for the ages, you know, made it a legendary night for HBO for that series, just because of how odd it was. Just one of the most bizarre nights, just in the potential he showed, and also a real harbinger for what was to come with Galata's career of, I don't know if it was wasted potential, but just that instability became a dominant theme in his narrative as a heavyweight.
Well, and you're not just throwing out hyperbole too when you talk about the talent of Riddick Bowe and the potential there. You have a guy in Eddie Futch who handled Riddick Bowe from like 1988 or something like that to all the way until the Galata fights. Excuse me. And this guy Futch, well, of course, worked with Joe Frazier. Ken Norton, I don't know. I mean, a whole shitload of fighters, Michael Spinks, Alexis Arguello. Anyway, he worked with a lot of people, and even Eddie Futch said that Riddick Bowe had the potential to be the best heavyweight that he ever worked with, which is obviously saying a lot. But it's not really hyperbole, though, when you see what Riddick Bowe was capable of at his best. So, I mean, a lot of people, I guess, hindsight's always 20/20. So it's easy to look back and say Riddick Bowe is on a downward trend, downward spiral, whatever, and the Holyfield fights took too much out of him. Sure, they did. And Eddie Futch also said that the excessive sparring and the constant gym wars also wore down Bowe, which is something I've heard from a number of trainers. But regardless, it still seemed like, it was a massive name. Riddick Bowe is still a massive name. And also, the funny thing is, even now in retrospect, to talk about Riddick Bowe and you'd be like, oh, you know, he was so washed up. Dude had 43-1. He had one loss over the course of his career. So it's kind of like, whoa, shit, really? I distinctly remember him losing like 5 times. And no, he lost once. So... anyway, it's a little bit of a wash, though, especially since he got his ass kicked so badly in both Galata fights. But that first fight, you know, like you said, the Legendary Knights episode is like very instructive. Wayne Kelly, who does Wayne Kelly even referee anymore? I don't know. I'm not even sure about anything. But regardless, oh, God, he died in 2012. I'm an asshole. Anyway, sorry, Wayne Kelly up there. On the Legendary Knights episode, he says that right before the fight, Andrew Galata looks him in the eye after Wayne Kelly's like, hey, like, no funny shit. And Andrew Galata looks him in the eye and says, I do what I have to do to win, or something like that. And that's probably about is the best way he could have put it right there. But that's true.
Oh, I mean, it was one of – I don't know that I was ever cheering against Bo. Because I thought Bo was a really fun heavyweight to watch. And part of what made him fun was he was just so amazingly talented with incredible size and skills. But he was already bragging, I think, around that time. It might have been in the pre-fight to that fight about how much weight he would gain in between fights and saying, you know, what do I really have to work for if I'm not trying to lose a ton of weight? So it was a, you know, major alarm going off that this was a guy who was not finding enough motivation just by making huge purses as a heavyweight champion. He wanted to go in there taking some real risk.
Yeah, and it's funny because you look at Andrew Golota over the course of like the first four or five rounds, and you see a guy who was you're not going to say unbeatable, but he obviously looked like a very formidable heavyweight during those first handful of rounds, and he just could not keep himself together, dude. He could not keep himself from self-destructing. And that was what the crazy thing was that it was like at a certain point, it almost seemed like he totally knew what he was doing and he just did not give a shit. Why?
It was bizarre. I mean, it was such a bizarre. I still don't know. I mean, even when you rewatch the fight, I mean, it's one of the things that makes it so thrilling is you're just like, he's not going to do it. I know it's coming, but I feel like there's some way he's just not going to go low and he's going to land the one punch that's missing to put Bo away. He was so close to it for so much of the fight of just missing one shot, like landing beautiful combinations, 2, 3, 4 punches, and you could just see Bo teetering like a tree just about to fall. It just needs one more swing, and Golota could never quite land it, and then all of a sudden he'd go low with such tenacity. The low blows were so viciously low. I mean, it became comical, but I mean, he was permitted to do it so many times as well that you just thought, Jesus, I mean, it's not a bad strategy if you can land 4 shots where you are just keying off on the guy's nuts and the guy still has to come and continue to fight and you can, you know, just not go low anymore. And we're going to get into the second fight where I think Lou Duva would set up heavy bags with a pair of shorts pulled up just to illustrate, don't hit below this line. And still, like, I mean, I don't know what was going on in his head that night because he was in great shape. He was in condition to almost run the table against Bo. I mean, took some shots against Bo. Bo's still fighting back. But boy, there was 5, 10 close calls there where Bo almost was put down for the count, but it just didn't happen. And still watching it, you know, you rewatch it and you're just like, this is an amazing thing to see happen, especially after you've seen the trilogy that Bo put on with Holyfield. It was just amazing to see somebody handle him so easily. It was not easily in the way that, say, Andy Ruiz handled Joshua, where there's the shot on the temple and then the equilibrium is rocked and you know he's a different guy for the rest of that fight. This was just outboxing him. I just think stylistically he had Bo's number. I'm not saying this is the same Bo that was in the first fight with Holyfield, but I still think Golota could have given him a fight, even at his best, just stylistically. Golota had something that gave Bo a lot of trouble. And you can see go ahead.
No, I agree. Sorry, go for it.
Well, I just think, like, it's one of those performances that showcased everything that Golota had where you just think, Jesus, like, this would give a lot of great fighters some real problems, because to see somebody that capable to punch in combination at that size – in condition to do it for a whole fight, you know, you just don't see a heavyweight that size with those kind of skills and that kind of hand speed and cleverness. I mean, really sneaky, shrewd, slick combinations and moving his head as well. I mean, Golota was a very impressively schooled fighter, and you could see Bo was very, very frustrated by him. So to see it go the direction it did, where at first you're just like, well, that clearly was an aberration when he went low. He's going to learn from that, and it gets worse and worse and worse, and ultimately degenerating into something so controversial and wildly improbable that there is a massive riot at MSG. I mean, it was incredible.
I think stylistically, you had it perfect, and also they had a great strategy as far as how to deal with Riddick Bowe, and Andrew Golota fairly consistently kept him rocked back on his heels. And every time Riddick Bowe was trying to get inside and get some momentum, Golota would start moving and using angles and then come back and rock him back on his heels again. And it was perfect. The way that he was executing it was really, really good. And if he had just, you know, not been able to hit him in the fucking nutsack, he would have done all right, but he couldn't help himself. But another thing they talk about in that legendary night is how the atmosphere just made for a perfect storm. You know, we talked about the ethnic makeup of Andrew Golota and coming from Poland to Chicago, where there was a lot of Polish people of Polish descent, massive sports fans, and very willing to get behind other Polish athletes. And so this first fight at Madison Square Garden had brought out a large Polish contingent, and also Riddick Bowe from Brownsville, not too far from Madison Square Garden in New York. And so it made for a very bad mixture. And also I think that perhaps the people who would be more likely to root for Bowe or an American or whatever might not have been familiar with the like football style rooting with a lot of flags, chants, fucking vazivuvalas with the, you know, fucking shit, the drums, the scarves, like, I mean, whatever. It's cool. I don't really care that much. I'm mostly just making fun because I make fun of everything. But nonetheless, I don't think that a lot of American fans would have, like, understood what the fuck. Like, they would have probably taken it as, like, wow, these guys are, like, just so aggressive. Whereas that's just a normal football match pretty much anywhere. And that misunderstanding, that kind of cultural difference also, I think, heightened the tensions. And you, one of the things Lampley says on the Legendary Nights is that you don't need to wear a jersey, or you don't need to wear, you know, a rooting, something for a rooting fighter or anything like that, when it's basically like white Polish people against black people rooting for Bowe, when that's probably not 100% true, but nonetheless, it's probably more true than not. And it was bad shit, dude. That was real bad. You got that was the one where Lampley's going, my kids are somewhere in the arena, I need to go find them. You know, George Foreman's fools are rushing the ring, and George Foreman, don't do it, son. You know, George Foreman almost has to handle business against people. And actually, when you see the video, the person stops. They're like, okay, because it's George Foreman. What the fuck are you going to do? Nothing. Is the answer. So, I mean, anyway, yeah, that was, I remember that shit. I remember that was pretty intense shit. Like, and that was something where, like, dude, you see a lot of ridiculous stuff in boxing, and okay, you know, I'm not going to argue that, but you don't always see riots like that, where it's like, damn, dude, I think I might be seeing somebody dying right now in the crowd. Holy shit. It was pretty rough.
Oh, it was brutal. I mean, it was a horrendous riot. That was super dangerous. It was dangerous in the ring, and it looked far worse outside of the ring. I mean, you had Rock Newman, Bo's manager, bashing that, you know, looked kind of like it was when Fan Man. I mean, there was just such chaos. I think Golota had a massive cut in his head from one of Bo's entourage. And it was just wild everywhere else. And I don't think you are overstating the, you know, the racial underpinnings of some of that riot, because I think Lampley's not far off. I mean, I just think there was a friction about those, you know, the dynamics of that crowd that was felt, and I'm sure an abundance of alcohol didn't help matters, you know, mitigate any of the animus. And, you know, it's just, you can just get carried away into that kind of thing. You know, the kind of energy that crackles when you have a Mexican fighter at MSG versus a Puerto Rican. I mean, there's nothing really like it. I've never been around, Margarito Cotto 2, even though the fight may not have been of the most significance in terms of where the boxing world was, but boy, that energy there of what Puerto Rico wanted from Cotto to do in revenge for what had happened for the first fight was an incredible atmosphere to be around. And Galata, you know, Galata really had a lot of connective tissue to that crowd that night. So when it went wild in the ring, it just infected the whole place in a way that was, you know, incredible to see. And it was just total bedlam. And I think it laid the stage for a lot more excitement for the second fight, which, all of Galata's side was trying to carry the momentum from his success in the first fight to say, you know, we just make some very small adjustments. You're just going to blow this guy out of the water. And on Bo's side, it became really evident that the slide that had occurred that was evident in the first fight, that this was the tenor of Bo's career going forward. Is he, you know, it's a harsh thing to say, but he was a shot fighter from who he was at his peak. You know, he was nowhere near that guy and was not capable of being that guy who fought Holyfield in the first fight ever again. And it wasn't just a matter of discipline, even though that was still an issue. The body clearly was not in the kind of shape that he used to be able to get into, but mentally, emotionally, you know, he was not up for fighting at the top any longer. And I think we've seen it with where Bo is now, where I've only seen Bo at a few events. I've only engaged him a couple of times, reporting on Shannon Briggs and a couple of other places. But I mean, there's the lights are not on. And I don't mean that dismissively to attack him. But like, clearly he is a very, very damaged person as a result of his career. And I think a lot of that damage is the result of Holyfield and Galata. I think Galata hit him so many times clean in their two fights. It's hard to watch because a guy that size hitting you clean 30, 40, 50 times in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, I don't know many guys who could have stayed upright, you know, but there's a price for that too.
Well, and he took a sustained beating, whereas, you know, it might have just been better off if he had been TKO'd in like two rounds or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, if Galata had just stepped forth and really pressed the issue and knocked him out, I don't know if he could have. I'm not saying that, but just in terms of Bo's long-term health, it would have been better off for him probably. But, the crazy thing is that it was still pretty plainly recognized, like you said, that Bo was obviously on the slide. And yeah, he might have taken him lightly. He was supposed to finally get in the ring with Lennox Lewis, and they had like a tentative agreement or something like that to fight in like 96 or 97. And, Bo had more or less avoided him, like you said, ever since getting TKO'd by him in the Olympics, and literally ditched the WBC belt, threw it in the trash at a press conference, like in the literal trash can, because he didn't want to have to fight Lennox Lewis, and he said he didn't like the way that they were operating, blah, blah, blah. So the crazy thing was, even though it was plainly recognized that Bo was on the slide and that he might not have trained all that well for Galata or whatever, when the rematch was made for Atlantic City, that was kind of like the stomping grounds for main events, and which was Galata's trainer. And it was, I mean, the impression that I got anyway was that Galata was basically being given a number of advantages going into the rematch, despite what had happened in the first fight. And, there's the footage of Lou Duva with the fucking boxing trunks over the heavy bag. So they're trying to, that's some awesome shit. Trying to make sure trying to make sure that Andrew Galata knows what boxing boxing trunks look like, apparently, and not to hit below the line on the boxing trunks. And no, it didn't work at all. Like, at all. And pretty much, the funny thing is Riddick Bowe wound up coming in like 20 pounds lighter. He looked much, much better, but you can't turn back time, Cher. It's not happening. And he just took a beating. He got his ass kicked again. Except this time, Andrew Gallada threw like scrotal combinations, man. Andrew Gallada used Riddick Bowe's nutsack like a speed bag. It was devastating to watch.
It really was. It was worse than the first one. And I mean, this was just, I mean, using his scrotum as a speed bag, full like driving range shots at the scrotum. And I mean, even Bo's face, I mean, I don't know why it becomes comical. Like, maybe just you need to laugh so you don't cry, but his face reacting to these shots, I mean, it seemed like it was a bad comedy. It seemed like a silly 1980s comedy where, you know, it's a staple of just somebody getting whacked in the nuts in a way that would be, you know, unthinkable that somebody could endure that kind of pain. Bo was taking it all the time throughout the fight by like a 6'4", 230-pound guy just winding up and just slamming him in the nuts like a massive, you know, hockey player going in for a slap shot on goal. It was just so bizarre. And accordingly, you know, the fight was stopped, I think, ninth round. So that closed the door on their rematch.
I mean, like, in literally, Andrew Gallada was given not only every like advantage going in, because again, Riddick Bowe, despite the fact that he had gotten in better shape, was clearly on the slide, didn't have the reaction time in the defense head movement that he had earlier on in his career, still had some power, and he managed to actually sting Gallada a few times too, but
yep.
he just couldn't follow up, was kind of sloppy, missing the mark, basically the hallmarks of somebody on the slide where they could see the opportunities but can't capitalize on them. Just, you know, classic shit. And there were moments it was just, man, the final combination is Andrew Gallada lands a right, left, right on the cup, but like the second and third shots are like almost uppercuts, like almost, like he gets some elbow into it. So I mean, I remember back in the day, there might be some people possibly who remember this if they listen, but what was his name? Bernard Fernandez or something like that. There was a dude in Northern mm-hmm. California who was a writer, and he was a former cop, and he had, I might be wrong on the last name, or I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but point is, he was a former cop, writer in Northern California, and he had run for a number of years, I believe it was ringtalk.com. Cliff Rold, who writes for Boxing Scene now and has been a writer for a long time and a guy I've known for a really long time, super nice guy, wrote for him. And anyway, the whole reason I bring it up is because this guy, I'm going to have to look it up now, he made a video in like maybe 2002 where he got into a ring, and I can't remember, it was in response to a specific fight where a fighter had been hit low, and he got into a ring with a fighter, and he was like plainly wearing a protector, like the foam protector on the outside of his shorts, like spandex shorts or something with a cup in it, to demonstrate that getting hit in the cup doesn't hurt. And he had this fighter sitting there wailing on his cup for like 5 minutes straight while he was talking to the camera. And I mean, first of all, it was some crazy shit. I mean, you know, you're just watching it and going like, wow, this guy is literally sociopathic. But I mean, beyond that, dude, I've had a cup on before. I've been hitting it. It doesn't feel good. Like it might not be like the cataclysmic devastation that some fighters fucking collapse in agony when it's like to tap tap. But we're talking like full on punches from a guy that's 240 pounds and knows how to punch in the dick. So anyway, I don't care what anybody's making videos about. That shit ain't going to feel good.
No. If there's anything down there and it's getting whacked by a 240-pound guy swinging wildly in combination, you're going down, and you're going down in pain.
And also, it's worth mentioning, too, and not to belabor the point, but, you know, pretty much every guy knows that you have that instinct that, like, when something's going in that trajectory, like, you know, to curl up and, you know, protect your Johnson. But in the boxing ring, it's like that. You can't have that, because if you know if you're going to be getting punches in that direction all the time, whether it's to your body or an uppercut, and you can't just assume it's going to hit you in the wang. You have to assume that shit's going to be legal, because that's, you're in a boxing ring. So it's almost like you see Bo get hit by him, and it's like he's twice as unprepared as the normal human being would be, and he's just like, oh God. Anyway, now that we've successfully turned every guy who's going to listen to this episode off of coitus for the next 24 hours, I'm sorry. No quarantine sex for you guys. It was awful.
Or appreciate the coitus that you're having during the coronavirus even more. Think of the way it could be.
Indeed.
If you were Riddick Bowe.
But to not only do it once, you know, and it's not like he just had a real bad, you know, wild punch in the first fight. You know, he hit him with many low blows, but then he hit him with many low blows again, given every opportunity to keep going. You know, Riddick Bowe, for some reason, kept getting up and wasn't like, fuck this guy, DQ him, I'm not getting up, because he pretty much had every right to do that, but kept getting up until the last one, totally understandable. And I mean, somehow Andrew Gullotta actually came back from not only those two fights, but he wound up coming back more than Bo did. And I will say, though, Andrew Gullotta did beat Riddick Bowe's ass so bad that Bo joined the Marines for like 2 days, but still he joined the Marines.
Oh, I mean, that's where Bo's career just goes so far off the rails. Where it's just like, what the fuck has happened to him? Because, yeah, joins the Marines for a couple of days, and guess what? Basic training, like, is not easy.
Yeah, no shit.
Like, what am I doing here? I guess he hadn't seen Full Metal Jacket, but it was, yeah, just bizarre. And you kind of knew both guys' careers after this were not, you know, they were not going to go back to you know, the kind of direction that they were at in the first place in terms of being elite level heavyweights that were in contention with anybody who held the title or holding the title themselves. Like, they were going to become sideshows. And yeah, Bo's career certainly went that direction. I mean, he was clearly never the same and just seemed like his whole life. Then he gets into trouble for kidnapping his kids and a bunch of really heinous, fucked up, I mean, almost comically fucked up shit. But, you know, Gullotta, it seemed, you know, as you say, I mean, just boy, the white privilege of being elite white heavyweight, of immediately getting a Lennox Lewis title shot. I mean, incredible that he remains the number one contender after two fights in a row doing what he was doing. And,
yeah.
You know, and then that mess, and, you know, steps in there against Michael Grant also and has some moments. I mean, he still wasn't done, but it was just kind of sad.
Yeah, and actually, you know, it's somewhat amazing that Gullotta came back from that, given that he was basically, you know, beaten into submission without any, without much coming back. I mean, even after being DQ'd twice against Riddick Bowe, the problem is that you could still see the talent. You could still see the skill. You could still see that the guy was capable. He was a highly capable heavyweight that just couldn't keep it together mentally. The presumption being that if he could, that he'd be all right, you know, that he'd be able to maybe stay in there against a Lennox Lewis. But this was also, you know, by 1997, I think that that was also Andrew Gullotta had the misfortune of meeting Lennox Lewis as he was hitting his stride, as he was hitting kind of like his later career stride as apart from the Haseem Rahman hiccup, you know, a pretty dominant heavyweight and very skilled heavyweight. So anyway,
absolutely.
You also,
I mean,
got
Lewis
to see... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Lewis absolutely annihilates him in one round, destroys him. And, you know, Lewis, other than, as you say, having two hiccups with Oliver McCall and Rahman, I mean, both of those, I think he did as much as you could possibly do to prove that they were just, you know, there was really nobody other than Vitaly Klitschko that was ahead on the scorecards by the time Lewis beat him as the fight was stopped. But, you know, Lewis showed his supremacy for his era in a way that nobody really came close to what Lewis achieved by the time he retired. And you're absolutely right. I mean, he was peaking at the time that he faced Gullotta. And you know, anybody who says that Lewis is a boring fighter, I mean, I don't think he has the most compelling personality. Granted, he's from my native, you know, Canada's where he learned to box, and I think his personality was very, you know, sort of Canadian, just sort of bland, like most of us. But there was a, you know, when he wanted to step on the gas, he was such an unbelievably dangerous competitor in the history of the heavyweight division. I mean, I still don't know who the hell wants to go in there against Lennox Lewis. It seems like he would be the last guy you would want to step in the ring with that's ever walked into the ring with the kind of skill, talent, power, intelligence, composure. He's just so much to deal with, and he just annihilated Gullotta in one round.
A pissed off, motivated, aggressive Lennox Lewis is a scary fighter. I mean, I don't know that he had the chin or toughness to maintain that approach against somebody who had a really good chin and could like dish it back. But I also don't know how many of those fighters exist or have ever existed that could take, you know, a massive Lennox Lewis combination as he's pissed off and going like, fuck this, and just biting down and fire back. Like, there aren't a whole lot. So not to, you know, ride Lennox Lewis too hard here, but the point is that even so, even getting annihilated by Lennox Lewis is, I don't want to say forgivable, but it's you know, it's understandable. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's just that the circumstances leading to Andrew Gullotta getting that shot in the first place, like, don't really make a whole lot of sense. But then, you know, actually, the crazy thing about this, and one of the things that almost never gets talked about, is after the Lennox Lewis fight, Gullotta supposedly had some sort of like syncopal episode or some shit like that in his locker room and had to go to the fucking emergency room and basically like get revived or something like that. And for whatever reason, it wasn't really widely reported on. You know, compared to how it generally would be when a fighter collapses in his dressing room and shit. I mean, holy shit, you know? But that's literally what happened. And even despite that, he didn't really skip much of a beat and was fighting six months later.
Amazing. No, and he, I mean, you tell me if you felt this also, but there was something about the first time that he went down against Lewis, And sometimes when he was taking shots from Bo, it just didn't look very good. Like, it was ominous to see the expression on his face look like a guy having a stroke. Or, you know, like
the grimace.
A seizure. Yeah, there was just a, like, his eyes would get wide, and he'd just look like he was in a different world.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a guy unconscious. It was just like he went into, he just crossed into some other dimension. And I just thought, oh, this is not good. There's something really going on in this guy's brain that is probably not conducive to him coming back really determined to win this fight. It just looks like, it was just odd. It was just very odd, almost like a guy in a monster movie transforming into something else. And, you know, not to say he couldn't take some big shots. He did. He had a pretty sturdy chin. But there were times when it finally got to him where it looked like you were seeing somebody being damaged for life. Like, that's what it appeared to be. When he'd fall down, the look on his face kind of said, oh, I guess I've lost 10% cognitive ability. It was something, like, it was just something about it that was distinctively scary.
Yeah, and, I mean, I don't want to, like, Sherlock Holmes this shit because it probably doesn't really need it. But after the fight, it was reported that Galata had actually gotten an injection of lidocaine, which can be used as a painkiller, but is also used for several other things. Like, it's used in dentistry. It's used in a lot of things. But it sounds like he got a lidocaine injection in his right knee, which would, I guess, kind of be like a cortisone injection in terms of what they're trying to achieve. He's just, his knee hurts, and so he wants to numb it enough to fight through it or something. But I don't know who injected it, and I'm not insinuating anything, but I do know from having worked in the medical field that an overdose of lidocaine can lead to seizure, can lead to cardiac episodes, can lead to a whole bunch of other shit. So I don't know what was going on in Galata's brain before getting punched by a fucking 250-pound man, but I'm just saying, you know, it probably was like a little bit of a perfect storm of shit that was going around. And anyway, there was a lawsuit and all this type of shit that Galata, he like sued the doctor who injected him and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, it probably just winds up being a footnote in his career, which is the craziest shit of all because of how much stuff happened. I mean, going down the road, you look at what he, you know, his performance against Michael Grant, where he's actually doing very well against Michael Grant in a number of the rounds, you know, beat the crap out of him in a few rounds, and credit to Michael Grant for actually standing through it, despite the fact that he was very clearly not a natural fighter and more of a basketball player turned fighter and looked like it. But he basically just lasted through it and waited until Andrew Galata folded, which he did. And then you see how Lennox Lewis handled Michael Grant, and it's like, ah, oh, okay, I get it. You know, it kind of makes sense that we speak of Lennox Lewis in the, you know, dominant terms that we do. And then bowing out against Mike Tyson in a very similar way to, or at least say the way that he looked when he got hit, kind of like you said, against Lennox Lewis, he had the kind of same expression against Mike Tyson where he was like wide eyed and like, holy shit, what did I get myself into? Well, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard like, the fuck, did you get hit by something? But no. Oh, okay. No, I mean, just you were seeing him kind of just implode, you know, imploding in a different way. He wasn't necessarily fouling, but he was just showing up for fights, but not really there.
No, you're right. I mean, where he goes after Lewis, I mean, he fights Tim Witherspoon, who is another guy, kind of a ghost of Christmas past Christmas future for Galata, just in the sense that Witherspoon was always just on the brink of winning a title, you know, just you know, with lots of problems with Don King and that sort of thing, but manages to beat Witherspoon, loses to Michael Grant by a knockout in the 10th round, but, I mean, scored a couple knockdowns in the first round, showing his class there, like, you know, you were saying, but then it's, you know, Galata by this point is getting up there. You know, he's an old 32 by the time he gets in there with Mike Tyson in 2000, and it's just a weird fight. It's an ugly fight. Tyson by this time is a much, much more limited fighter than we'd seen before, and, you know, all of the kind of attached publicity and marketing of Tyson around that time was that, like, somehow he was going to reclaim his greatness. You know, he still had the possibility of showing glimmers of that. By the time you see him against Galata, I mean, he's just such a limited one-dimensional fighter. He's a puncher with really fast hands, but really doesn't have more than three rounds. You could see Tyson was very aware of his own stamina by then, but had more than enough to just totally derail Galata. And, you know, it's weird to think, I mean, researching some of this to talk to you, that Galata stuck around boxing for like 21 years.
And he had like an entire almost like second career. Because
yeah,
I mean,
he did.
That's what was really crazy was that he was all but done. And, you know, he had the seizure, whatever it was, episode after the Lewis fight. And that was in 97. He loses to Michael Grant. And then in the Mike Tyson fight, he chipped something like in his cervical vertebrae or something like that, like near his brainstem. And if, you know, something could have caused a catastrophic event and that could have killed him or something like that. And almost in retrospect, you're like, well, damn, you probably a good thing you quit then, because Mike Tyson would have killed your ass. You know, he was not having that shit that night. And he threw a fit because he wanted to beat Andrew Galata's ass some more and then wound up testing positive for weed like an idiot and declared no contest. But for a couple of years, Andrew Galata pretty much disappeared. I know that he had been at gyms because there was video of him around that time training, but I don't know if anybody even really took him serious. But then he defeated a couple of scrubs guys that were also rans at in the early 2000s and got a shot at Chris Bird, which I personally thought he won. I thought he defeated Chris Bird, and then he got a shot at John Ruiz. So he got a shot at two different heavyweight titles back to back.
Amazing.
He gets a draw against Chris Bird, which I again thought he won, and then John Ruiz, which I also thought he won. So it was fairly crazy because it was like, well, shit, dude, he came out of nowhere, and here he is. He's on my card beating two of the heavyweight title holders and two guys that they say Lennox Lewis was avoiding at the time or right before he retired, which I don't really give much credence to. But then, perfect scenario again, the dude gets thrown a third title fight in a row. The WBO wasn't really, it was kind of still somewhat fringe at the time. It's far more recognized now. But against Lehman Brewster in Chicago, basically he was like, they're like, okay, here you go. Here's the weakest title holder that we have right now. And in your, you know, transplanted hometown, take it. And he got fucking annihilated. I remember that shit.
Yeah.
There were so many Polish people in the crowd, and they were just like, it went from like rah, to crickets. Holy shit.
That was brutal. Brutal.
Just rough.
And you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. I thought he won two close draws. I mean, I thought he won a draw with Chris Bird, and I completely disagreed with the John Ruiz unanimous decision. It's weird. I mean, it's just really weird how many chances Galata got and just the bad luck he had combined with how unstable he was with Bo. But, I mean, this guy could have been, like, the weirdest, most makeshift, cobbled-together three-time heavyweight champion. It's amazing.
Yeah, man, they almost Frankenstein this fool together in the early 2000s,
yeah.
Man, like, What if he had won all three of those fights? You know, we would have been, I guess we still would have had some, you know, Soviet or, you know, border Soviet domination. But nonetheless, it would have been a slightly different conversation if only those decisions had the well, Chris Bird was, if I'm not mistaken, with Don King. I know John Ruiz was with Don King. I don't remember who Lehman Brewster was with, but yeah, I mean, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying.
Well, and I think on top of that is, you know, and it's something I hesitate to bring up, but let's remember right around this time, there was another Polish heavyweight that was on the scene.
Who was that?
He's actually, you know, for my money, probably the most unheralded, underrated heavyweight fighter of all time. Certainly the most intelligent, at least according to an IQ test,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
to me is
mm-hmm.
the only measure of a man. You know, Bobby Chez, Andrew Galata, I'd pay for front row seats for that. And I'd wave a Polish flag at that event.
Hey man, if you put that on in Chicago, and actually what I think you could do is you put Premislav Saleta, Tommy Adamek, Andrew Galata, Bobby Chez in all four corners and just ring a bell and go. Pew! I'm telling you,
oh, yeah.
That shit would sell like fucking flapjacks, hotcakes, gangbusters, something like that.
And you dig up the bones of Chopin and just start throwing them at a piano to play while it's going on.
Why not? Why not? It'll be like that scene in The Goonies, fucking the bone piano with the skulls and shit. It'll be great. Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're sick.
Yeah. But no, I think it is just Galata. I mean, that's why I thought this would be a fun one. This is such a bizarre career, and even, you know, losing to Bird, getting the draw with Bird, losing to Ruiz, gets fucking annihilated with Brewster. We still got him for 8 more years. Like, I mean, he doesn't fight too much, but God, he is a fucking cautionary tale of just how, he just becomes a punching bag for guys. I mean, after Kevin McBride, which is just, to me at the time, because that was so miserable. If you were a Tyson fan, watching Kevin McBride just destroy a slumped over, overweight Tyson. So I was pleased that Galata was able to do what he did to him in 2007 at MSG, knocked him out in the 6th round, but it doesn't go well from there for Mr. Andrew Galata.
Yeah, there was, I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was somewhat recently, and now I'm going to have to Google it or something. Oh, okay, it wasn't that recently. It was 2012. But he was apparently facing deportation from the U.S. And mind you, he's been in the U.S. since 1990. This has been, you know, this has pretty much been his home. But he was facing deportation because when he had filed paperwork to be a U.S. citizen, he had, I guess, some firearms charge and some charge for impersonating a police officer. I just don't understand the fucking impersonation shit. But anyway, it seems that our buddy is kind of still up to some tricks. He didn't really learn his lesson.
I could see him trying to arrest some like attractive woman. You are under arrest for being too attractive.
I do what I have to do to get date.
Come with me.
Okay, here we go. Wait, here's, oh, okay. We got, hold on. I got something here. Where's, all right. Andrew Galata, a well-known Chicago boxer, legal permanent resident and Polish immigrant, is now in removal proceedings and facing deportation. Galata is a perfect example, blah, blah, blah. 2 years ago, Galata filed his paperwork, the USCIS, to become a naturalized U.S. citizen, triggering a background check revealing 2 misdemeanors, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, yeah. So I don't see anything more recent than that, but that's pretty funny. Fucking Galata, dude. Yeah, that's exactly why when you suggested talking about Andrew Galata, I was like, no, it's a great idea. because as I opened up saying, you know, boxing, it's like its own poetry, both in terms of the mechanics of it, like watching, you know, physically, the aesthetics, the beauty of it. But beyond that, it so encapsulates like everything about the human condition, the fucking sadness and the despair and the folly and the ridiculousness and the joy and the victory and the, like, everything, the irony, everything, man. Literally, you get everything. And then every so often, there's a fighter who pretty much has everything over the course of his career. You know, Rick Bowe's another one. Somebody who just, like, draws attention, or Rock Newman in the fucking Bogalata Legendary Nights is like, how does this stuff always find us? Like, well, there's a common denominator there, buddy. Might start looking at the map, but anyway, you know, nonetheless, Riddick Bowe had it too. Just a career where there was like everything. Some guys from history had it because they just had such a long career, so many fights that they were bound to see literally everything there was. But other guys like a Galata or a Bowe just attracted the bullshit. And we are thankful for it.
I mean, colorful. I mean, the surprises that these guys generated, especially, you know, the latter chapters of their career are, they're just, you know, they're just personalities. I mean, both Bowe and Galata, you know, are guys where there's just always going to be something interesting about wherever it goes. If they win, if they lose, if it's something that's going way off the rails, it's worth watching. And more, you know, there's less of that as these things get more and more professionalized and curtailed. And I'm not saying it should be all this kind of messy, chaotic bullshit, but from my point of view, it is fun when there's an element of chaos thrown into the mix of whoever they're fighting. And, you know, Galata fought a lot of big names in the sport, definitely showcased the potential that he had, but on the other hand, was a fucking mess, like just a complete mess.
But I guess, you know, it's like when you walk into the living room of a 41-year-old suburban white lady with four kids, and you look up and there's this little sign hanging above the chimney that says, bless this mess. Bless this mess, Andrew Galata. He is a mess, and bless him.
He's got a Legendary Nights on HBO and maybe one of the most fun to watch. So, you know, career well done.
Yeah, it's great shit. So we're going to have to think of some other fighters to do these kind of dissections on and these remembrances on. But I know that Aris and I got something planned. What? I don't exactly know, but we'll be back with some shit. In the meanwhile, Bryn, I appreciate you taking the time to remember our good Chicagoan friend, Andy Galata.
My second favorite fighter of Polish descent.
Indeed. Speaking of which, I got a little whiskey in the cupboard. I'm going to have to go take a drive later.
Pick up some more.
That's right. I'll drink it on the way to pick up some more. Fuck me. Anyway,
well, I mean, one group that we're not talking about is Mothers Against Drinking and Driving. It's a lot harder to donate to them when there's nobody on the road drunk.
That's true. They're losing out. They are losing.
And we're
out.
Talking
we
about all the victims
about
that are out there, but you know, one group. These are the unsung heroes.
Oppressed and distressed. It's awful. We're gonna dedicate the next episode to MAD, I think, and we're gonna try to start a new one. MFDA, Mothers for Drunk Drive. I can't even say it. I can't even because I've been drinking. So. Now, everybody, you know, look, we like doing this history shit and the crass comedy I'm not that sorry for, but we got to stay sane during these crazy ass times, and I hope everybody's staying safe. I hope you're staying safe, Bryn.
I'm trying to in a, you know, quarantined in Stamford, Connecticut. It's kind of weird, but I'm getting used to it. It's a month now.
It certainly could be worse, you know. You could be quarantined in worse places, that's for sure.
Well, I could be quarantined in New Jersey.
Exactly.
With Bobby Chez.
Yes. Or Chicago with Galata after we do this shit. He's going to fucking hate us.
Yeah, that was not a slur against New Jersey. It was specific to being in New Jersey where one specific man lives who I do not want to be quarantined with. Nothing
no,
against New Jersey.
Not at all. Hot damn. Well, everybody, thank you so much for sticking with us. Why you did, I don't know, but we appreciate it. And you're sick too, so we take that comfort. In the meanwhile, if you wouldn't mind following us on social media, it's appreciated. On Twitter, follow Bryn at Brynicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And also, if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page and throw us a like there. But probably more importantly, or at least as I understand anyway, go to all the podcasting apps, whichever ones you use, subscribe to us and give us a rating. Because that's helpful. That's it, man. Bobby, and stay away from us.
And go ahead and follow Bobby Chez. If you're walking around New Jersey and you see him driving around, keep an eye on him. You could save a life, even your own.
Yeah, call the fucking animal shelter or something. Just stay away.
Wanaka, right. New Jersey. That's where he's supposed to be.
That's right.
So be careful out there, kids.
All right, bro. I will talk to you soon. Everybody, take it easy.
See you later, man. See you later, everybody.